right now. Welcome to Pro 777 Radio. This is hour one of episode 688. Jason Lingren is with me and Daniel Brody joins us. We're going to be talking about a thing that I've been looking at for over a decade. I've been talking about aspects of this as long as I've been in the public sphere. Basically, if you haven't noticed, there are a couple things that are major in the world right now. One is there's an era change actively happening. Another thing is we have a group of, I guess I'll call them the technocracy, doing everything they can to take over every human life in the world in real time and then police it with technology. We're going to be talking about aspects of this, tuning into language. What Daniel brings with him is the idea that there could be solutions in paying attention to the use of language in this regard. Anyhow, welcome, Jason.
Oh, and a hot and humid good morning.
We're getting copious amounts of rain, and I still have had no opportunity to shoot in this month, but let's get down to it. Welcome, Daniel. Can you please introduce yourself, your background, if you wish, and offer out any links or websites you'd like to?
Sure. My name is Daniel Brody. Thanks for the invitation to talk. It's a really great opportunity to have conversations with people of like interests. Like you, I've been asking very similar questions over the past 20 years, especially after 9/11. I started actually becoming more critically aware of how language is used to manipulate our emotions and our, I guess, our psychological states when I was in the military in Panama. So that's, I think, when I was in my mid-20s, I kind of woke up and was able to see the difference between the mediated world, the mediated reality, and the empirical world. And I think that's what really got me interested in linguistics. So that's my background, my academic background. It sort of dovetails with some of the work that I was doing in the military so many years ago. Originally, I'm from the U.S. You can probably tell by my accent, but I've been living outside of the United States for the past few decades.
Do you have any websites or anything else you'd like to offer, or shall we move forward?
I'm a co-editor for Propaganda in Focus. I'll just drop the link to that in the chat. And for anyone interested in my work, you can find a lot more of the work that I've been doing at researchgate.net. I'll drop the link in the chat as well.
All right. Well, we'll jump in here and I'll preface it. There's some very odd things going on now. For most of my life, my younger life, I thought there was something wrong with me because I walked through a world where I recognized very little of it was right. And at first I thought people didn't realize it was right. And then later I thought, well, they know what I know, but they're okay with it, which was troubling to me. Later in life, 9/11 happens. And at that point, everything is jolted in a non-complacent space that I'd been living in. And I really begin to look at just how messed up things are. But every time I try to talk about it, you're pretty much getting shut down. Not too long after that, 2020 happens. At that point, it is my feeling that people who may have remained asleep their whole life are jolted towards awareness. But still, after everything that's happened and people waking up and beginning to realize what I've been looking at since I was in my 20s, it's almost like there's a Stockholm effect going on where people can't possibly imagine life without the cage, which has become so blatantly obvious. But with that, where would you like to pick up?
Well, maybe we can begin with the cage. I think a lot of people who do research on this topic think in terms of the technocratic cage that's being constructed or the digital panopticon. I think it's also been referred to as the control grid.
Skynet is what I've been calling it.
Right. Yeah, there are various names, and it seems as though, you know, even in my experience, lots and lots of people you try to talk to about these sorts of developments, these technological developments, you know, where can you talk about them? Academic conferences, it's difficult because many academics, it seems as though academia, the academy has been captured. Lots of people don't want to talk about these things. You can get canceled by your university. You lose friends. So I've asked the same questions, but it seems as though many people are willfully blind. They don't want to wake up and, you know, look around them and look carefully at how these technologies are being deployed right before their very eyes. And one of the things that I've tried to teach my students is sort of developing a kind of a basic awareness of how propaganda works in democracies. It's been pointed out before by scholars going back decades that in Western democracies, propaganda is a necessary evil, as it were. Of course, contrast that with totalitarian regimes where the bludgeon is always ready to hit someone over the head or lead them off to jail, prison, lumber camp, if they say something that goes against the powers that be. Been generally in for many, many decades in Western democracies, propaganda has been a huge part of the media landscape. So I try to teach my students about how to recognize this. It's not just words these days. You know, we live in a society that is saturated with colors and images, signs and symbols and moving pictures. And so the rhetorical phenomena that in oral cultures has exploded into all kinds of communications phenomena that are really difficult to wrap your mind around if you're not critically aware. I begin with Clark's third law of failed imagination, where he notes that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. And I got to thinking about, especially since 9/11, and more so since 2020, when the Corona story was kind of rolled out, and we were largely castigated for asking basic scientific questions about why we all have to line up, shut up, and, you know, roll up our sleeves. And, you know, so why was that urgency pressed upon millions of people around the world? And we couldn't ask any questions about it. You know, this is obviously a propaganda campaign. So I thought that I think there's some obvious laws of propaganda at work that we could formulate. One of them is that the claims of any sufficiently compensated technologist or scientist or physician, politician, or media personality are virtually indistinguishable from the truth. So the more compensated you are as a professional carrying forward the narrative, the more compensated you are, the more difficult it is for regular people to discern what's true, because the mediated reality nowadays is, you know, it's everywhere. The channels of mainstream or corporate media have exploded through digital technologies, and we can pull a TV out of our purse or our pants pocket and dial in or tune in to the narrative.
Which is a curated narrative across all the channels, even when the channels appear to be opposing each other. But what you just mentioned, when I look back on that time, I was put in a position where, again, I was absolutely the odd man out. I was thrown out of nearly every place around me that I'd known for years, and I'd been going in to buy food or whatever. But what really bothered me was the moment this began to happen, I knew damn well that what they were trying to get me to do was dangerous. And I didn't understand how others didn't recognize the danger. And then I saw others getting it. I was even in positions, I was in a CVS, and there was a mother there with her clearly adopted Asian daughter, and they were talking about getting a series of the shots. And I'm looking at this young lady, beautiful, young lady, and I'm dreading. I feel like I need to go over there and say something, but at the same time, I know what will happen if I do, not just probably from their reaction, but from the people administering the poison. And everywhere I looked, I saw very few people who had the fear of urgency that I was recognizing in what was being promulgated.
Yeah. You know, like, I think it was in the 1960s, there was some really good work coming out of France. Jacques Ellul, he was a political philosopher and theologian. He came up with, I'm not sure if you've heard of his book, Propaganda, the Formation of Men's Attitudes.
I have, yeah. Yep.
Yeah, it's really good. Maybe one way to explain this sort of trance-like response to the media narrative is the effectiveness of integration propaganda, which he points out that the goal is to urge people to conform to the desired patterns of thought and behavior. And he points out in his book that this conformity is almost natural to people in societies that are rich in information, and the more comfortable and cultivated the society is, the more they're likely to respond positively to integration propaganda. So I was actually talking to my students about this the other day. They're curious too, like, why did so many people in Japan not make a big stink about being urged by the television every day to go and get their shot, you know?
Well, there is a cultural difference there, though. When you look at a society like Japan, they work together and are far more concerned with insulting one another in a group than we are here in America, just to make the point.
Yeah, yeah. That's actually a question one of my grad students was talking about, the stereotype, trying to hypothesize whether the stereotype is true or not when Japanese people tend to obey power and authority. Is this necessarily true? So he's been looking at that question over the past year. And some of the results are actually quite interesting. What he did was try to replicate Solomon Asch's study of obedience to authority. You might recall, 1950s, pretty famous experiment. The test subject is just one person, and this person is led into a classroom or auditorium and is seated in front of a screen with different lengths of lines, and the test subject has to pick what, say, there are three lines of various lengths, and they have to choose the line that is equal in length to the X line. And what Asch discovered was that about 30% of the test subjects, this is in the 1950s, about 30%, just over 30% of the test subjects, they just go along with the group. And they don't really pay any attention to what they're perceiving. You know, their own eyes are betraying them, and they just go along to get along, as it were. So my student was asking this very same question. Why is it that most people, they didn't stop to think more carefully about the story? Is there some kind of story behind the story? And I thought to say that one possible explanation is that we live in a relatively rich society, convenience stores everywhere, and you know, we don't have to go fishing to get some onigiri, we don't have to go out in the field and gather rice. So convenience and relative comfort, we become more subject to integration propaganda, because likely we don't want to lose our place in society. You know,
complacency at a level.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point.
I think there's something to that. And another thing that I'll notice while we're talking about this, where you're explaining that a group of people, you know, like the line thing, you know, they're agreeing on something they know is wrong, whether they're paying attention or not, because it's more important to them for whatever reason to go along with the group. But another thing that I'm noticing now is this idea that we can get through this bad part we're doing now, and then we'll get back to the way it was, this kind of mindset, refusing to recognize that, as an example, 2020 ruined the majority of business and establishments and the things that made the old way possible in the first place. But the idea that we're going back to some time that was okay overlooks that it wasn't okay, and that was the run up to what happened.
Yeah.
But to pull us back around to the language, let's try to focus in on the language and cognition, where you really have quite a bit to offer.
Yeah. So if we can agree that, I think, well, there are many ways to understand lots and lots of theories and models of communication that have been put forward over the past number of decades, at least since the early 20th century. So there's a lot to draw on. I really like how Jacques Ellul describes the effectiveness of integration propaganda. We see it too. In Japan, there's one of the technocratic efforts that's been in play for over the past 10 years. In Japan, we call it My Number. And for us as Westerners, I think the name is kind of creepy. My Number instantly calls up images of, you know, Revelation 13. But in Japan, this like My Number effort is really that just the digital ID. It's biometric sort of digital ID. And that is presented in the media as something cute. In Japan, there's a kind of like a cult of cuteness. So you have like a cute bunny rabbit and a pretty young Japanese girl and
Hello Kitty.
Yeah, it's Hello Kitty-ish. And it's integration propaganda. The coloring and lots of the messaging is light blue, powder blue. It relaxes the nerves. And then, of course, you get the pretty face that's inviting and reassuring. And yeah, there's all kinds of really good examples of integration propaganda. But on the flip side, while we're being integrated in some messaging in the corporate media, we're also being agitated. So it's I guess it's kind of like a, how would you say, a carrot and stick sort of thing. The agitation propaganda, it's meant to throw you into a state of panic.
What's an example of the agitation? So I get the cute part, grabbing onto the cute culture. So, you know, they're getting into the heart of society with that. What is the agitation that goes with it?
Well, I mean, early on, you probably have the same memory as I do. You might recall late 2019, some of the first images that were coming out of Wuhan, China. There's the infamous one where these two figures clad in mop gear, I would say, you know, the white sterile mop gear. They're standing in front of what looks like a Chinese restaurant. And then there's a guy lying on the sidewalk behind them. It's very stark.
Right.
It's a great image. It's iconic. And it's incredibly, incredibly powerful propaganda. It's agitating to the nerves. And there's another one that's a video clip of somebody who's said to have collapsed in the street ill from a COVID-19 infection. And I think it was initially framed as a death. Somebody just, you know, fell over dead. But if you look at the clip very carefully, you can see that this person did not collapse free fall onto the concrete pavement, but caught himself. So a lot of the initial framing of the COVID story also served, I think initially it was a fear-driven campaign, the way it was framed, the words that were used, you know, the menace. Lots of people in the Western press thought to frame it as a sort of war. We're on a war footing here. So lots of war imagery was evoked in the descriptions. So that's agitation. You know, it sort of leads people from feeling anger and fear to taking action or refusing to act, being frozen with fear. And, you know, as Irlou points out, governments also use agitation propaganda when they want to pursue some revolutionary cause or some radical policy.
So here, the agitation that you're describing is almost always fear-based at some level, at the very least meant to make you feel uneasy or unsafe. But most of the time, I would say it's outright fear propaganda, the agitation part.
Yeah, yeah. It seemed to me that when I saw the first reports in late 2019, and I'm watching the television, I'm hearing the descriptions, and then the soundtrack is kind of the accompanying soundtrack to the story. You know, you got the violins, and there's a sort of menacing, foreboding feeling that was evoked by the soundtrack. I mean, that is all meant to stir deep fear and loathing.
Like it was a production.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, of course. I mean, that is, of course, what news media are, right? I mean, it's fundamentally theatrics. They're all about framing the story for mass consumption.
So let's actually try to be a bit specific in an effort to quantify how the perception and belief and behavior and language are being used as a tool.
Well, I think one way to think about it, any massive propaganda campaign, when we become consciously aware of communications in the mass media as a campaign, then it's likely to be part of some larger experiment. You know, propaganda itself is just an experiment on, you know, how people perceive and behave. But the experiment, of course, for us over the past, 6 years, has been a biomedical experiment. And I think we saw the effectiveness. We can, if you want to quantify, use that term, you know, you saw the effectiveness of the propaganda campaign and the number of sleeves that were rolled up, arms that were submitted to the experiment.
Not to interrupt, but I was recently told it was 80% of the world, which I have a hard time believing, but I was told that by someone who knows things. Sorry for interrupting.
No, I think, I mean, it's hard to tell, but I mean, if you think about the times that we're living in when science discourse is suppressed everywhere, science pretends to be scientific, but we're not permitted to ask scientific questions anymore. You have to shut up and just follow the science, as it were. You know, the science is settled.
Yeah, settled. I was going to say the same thing. That came up over and over, that kind of language, where how dare you, this science is settled.
Right. That's right. How dare you? That's a famous, definitely famous refrain. I like also to, when I talk to my students about becoming more keenly aware of being played, I always try to think back to the times when I used to read maps. Anyone in the military knows how useful maps were and how interesting they were, the kind of perspective that you can gain when you see some really good quality maps of, say, the battlefield. Yeah, I mean, if you consider like the schooling system and the media system, I think careful criticism of the maps will help us recognize the kind of insanity that's masquerading as normality.
Are you referring to conceptual maps to each individual? What are you referring to exactly?
Conceptual maps. So like back in the early 20th century, I'm not sure if you've heard of Kozbiski, Alfred Kozbiski.
I haven't, no.
He kind of worked out, most linguists are interested in structure, syntax, but he became really interested in semantics. So he kind of worked out the details of meaning or semantics and logic. And one of maybe really famous book, Science, great title, by the way, Science and Sanity. And He argued that, you know, our careful observations of the world, inspired, of course, by scientific methods, they can really help us think more systematically about what we perceive to be real and true. So encouraging our friends and family members to take a step back and approach any problem with some humility and some scientific curiosity, that will go a long way. And I think this is like especially useful for us today, since so much of the information we consume, it comes from the mediated world. I'm sure you've heard this many, many times. People, for example, they'll say, follow the science, or they'll repeat some slogan that they heard on the nightly news, or they heard it in some echo chamber, and they're just repeating what they heard, which is, you know, it's just anti-scientific thinking.
It's effective propaganda.
Yeah. So one of the ways I try to get my students to open up their minds about alternative ways of understanding the world around them is to just be humble and ask questions in the spirit of the scientific mind that wants to pursue knowledge and truth for its own sake. So the widespread mediation of reality is a very big problem for people throughout the world, you know, seeking to understand what's true. So if we think about like a simple map, maps mediate what we might perceive about geographic spaces. I mean, I can remember in the 80s, we used to buy maps, keep them in a glove box. Rand McNally had these great atlases.
I still do that.
Oh, you see, so you're not tied to Google Maps. I think that's the most.
Yeah, I don't use GPS, no.
Yeah, so we're kind of analog that way. So I think they're really fun to read because, you know, they offer this other really interesting perspective on the world, and most of us don't really consider it that much anymore.
Well, I think you were getting ready to make the point using the physical street map that you begin to form a conceptual map in your mind. And I'm assuming you were going to translate that over to the propaganda, because I was about to ask you, how do these conceptual maps in regard to what we're talking about get formed in the first place?
Yeah, it's because of the maps of the world that are presented to us. I mean, who makes the maps? Well, let's say, for want of a better term, the owners of the world present the maps to us for consumption. And the maps that we would use in the military, for example, they were just representations of geographic spaces. Now, if you apply that to, say, language, even words themselves, they aren't the things they represent in the world. So I think it's becoming increasingly difficult to tell the difference between the map and the territory it's supposed to represent. If you think about, say, how words serve to map the world around us, how they point to real material things and also to conceptual things. For example, the words woman and man map onto humans possessing certain unique sets of sex characteristics. I mean, that was what we knew back in the 80s and 90s. And the former had a uterus and eggs. The latter has testes and seed. But that's kind of changing today, so I've heard.
Well, they're trying, yes. That's under attack.
Only with certain sects of thinking, we shall say.
Yeah, but you're going down an incredibly important world, because it's not changing, nor will it ever change, because all truth resides in nature. What's actually changing is the conceptual map or the mental space of the human being that either now believes a man can have a baby and menstruate or doesn't.
Hmm. That's right.
So in reality, there has been no change, but in reality, there's been a massive change because minds now have changed.
Yeah. So even in the face of obvious biological facts, you know, the past how many thousands of years of human history, the maps can be revised, or people can attempt to revise the maps to try to erase these key distinctions we've known for thousands of years between a man and a woman. I mean, if you apply that to, say, herd immunity, quote unquote, herd immunity, that phrase traditionally referred to like the ability of the of the human body and the ability to adapt and defeat a contagion. When enough people, they developed immunity through previous infection. So that's sort of like the natural path that the herd would become immune to further sickness. But you might recall, I think it was sometime in mid-2020, the definition of herd immunity changed. You might recall this. It became a kind of a concept used for vaccination. You can see how, is this ringing a bell?
Well, when the term herd immunity was used to get people to vaccinate?
Yeah. So it was modified. I forget who caught it. It was someone with a real eagle eye caught it and posted it on Twitter, the before and after shot. It was brilliant, the side-by-side definition. I think it might have been sometime in the spring of 2020. And then that was the before shot of the WHO's definition. And then the after the revision, I think maybe late 2020. So somewhere in between those months, the WHO modified its definition of herd immunity. So, I mean, you can see that. So in trying to do that, and trying to change the definition, it, of course, changed the conceptual map that we had of herd immunity. So it's grounded in the human body and made the concept grounded in some product. Before that time, before that change, we understood herd immunity as something that's a natural adaptation that humans developed when we were dealing with pathogens. But the conceptual map changed when herd immunity was explicitly connected to vaccination. Now, question is, why did the map change? I would suspect that the old definition needed updating for the global business practice of getting lots of needles into lots of arms.
Well, I mean, I could take a run at that for you. I think you're exactly right. Herd immunity before all this, in my mind, meant that we don't have to intervene because the herd will be around itself and nature will eventually deal with this and herd immunity will arise. The idea of that implied we don't need shots and other things. So what they did is they needed to reverse the meaning of that. But I'll put forward an idea here about how the conceptual map gets formed and why we're so far behind the eight ball. When we go out into the environment, we are surrounded by all these things which are normal. It's what makes up life. We go to a movie. We buy a product with a logo. We wear clothes that are a color. We buy cars that are a color. We listen to music that are frequencies. We do all these things. I would put forward to you that currently the conceptual map is formed universally. As an example of this, the movie Terminator put forward the idea of Skynet. It's sci-fi. It's not even a simile for what we're experiencing, but it's absolutely a metaphor, a very close metaphor to what they're trying to build with their digital concentration camp. And back then when we saw it, it was entertainment. It was popular. It was recognized as, I guess, an important film, and it hit culture everywhere. Later, it emerges to be the metaphor I'm talking about. But the point is that's already been put into your subconscious. Meanwhile, Jason and I have covered things like long before COVID, we were talking about the bird flu and this and that and Ebola. And I had noticed this weird shade of green in every AP news story and video. And we went and looked at it. And then it became very clear that this color green was being used to affect what people think. Then there's repetition. Then there's the tones that are delivered, and on and on and on we go. The biggest show in America in a period of time, the early 2000s, was The Big Bang. In that, they actually rolled out a show where the idea was people were going to get each other sick from breathing on each other, but they showed the COVID virus molecule looking thing years before we were that. That is the way our conceptual maps are being formed now. And a lot of it is subconsciously.
Yeah. So a lot of work was done in the early 20th century on subliminal messaging. Yeah, it's priming, right? Psychologically priming the audience for what's to come.
But in my mind, doesn't that make it much more difficult when the priming, as you put it, is universal and over vast periods of time compared to, you know, some period back in history where you weren't getting it from every side?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the world we live in today, like the point I was trying to make earlier, we're just awash with not just words, you know, like thousands of years ago, the ancient Greeks and Romans studied the effectiveness of words on the psyche, the emotions. And the world today, with mass digital communication, we have not just words, rhetoric has expanded to studies of signs and sign systems, symbols, colors, color psychology, images, even memes, right? All this is like, it's all embedded. The world that we live in, it's awash with all of these communications phenomena that have a serious effect on our emotional states and our perceptions of what's real and not real. So, yeah, I agree with you. It's a huge problem. I think it might have been Herman and Chomsky in the opening to their book, Manufacturing Consent, that pointed out, I'm kind of paraphrasing, I can't quite recall the whole thing, but it's a great quote, something to the effect that media are meant to inculcate the acceptable patterns of belief, the codes and patterns of belief in society, so that society becomes effectively integrated into the larger institutional structures, so, you know, to create order. So what the people at the very top want is order and predictability. That's why we're battling all these the forces of corporate propaganda that are arrayed against us.
Well, let me ask you a question. In Japan, how do people perceive COVID now after the fact? Is there a change in the perception, or is there not much of a change in the perception? And I mean the everyday people, not the organizations that are pushing the messages, just your neighbor. How is Japan viewing all that now? Is there regret? Is there a change?
Yeah, I think, especially over the past 2 years, my impression is that a lot of people are really waking up. What's interesting is that most young people, college students, are, in my estimation, they seem much more critical of the stories that are being offered in the mainstream media. They seem to be more questioning, which is really good. You know, when they first started rolling out the medications, as it were, in 2020, it was a very, very sad time. It was very troubling. I was an emotional wreck. Seeing young students fresh out of high school line up without question and just roll up their sleeves, it was really, really difficult time.
Would you estimate that those students who did that have a different perception on masks now? Do they recognize the danger at this point? Is there any regret?
That would be difficult to know because they've since graduated. But the younger students, like the freshmen nowadays, freshmen, sophomores, juniors, they seem to be more willing to question, to ask hard questions, ask good questions that definitely were not being asked during the greatest moments of panic. So I think that's a good sign.
That's critical. That's where things start. That's where, you know, a direction begins.
Yeah. And, you know, just to further that point, I mean, you're asking really good questions here. One of my graduate students who's doing this work in crowd psychology, he's reproduced the Solomon Asch study, I don't know, maybe 20 times over the past 5-6 months. And what's really heartening is to see that about 70%, 70 to 80% of the subjects in the study refused to go along with the crowd.
Wow.
I mean, that's quite shocking difference.
That's from, improvement.
I mean, that's an incredible improvement over the Solomon Ash findings, the original study. That's quite interesting.
What do we attribute that to? I kind of refer to it as the bridge too far mechanism. Like you get a thing like 9/11 and some people catch on and later more catch on and later, but then we have a 2020 on top of it. And then that becomes the bridge too far for many, many people.
Oh, I'm with you. Yeah, that might well explain the resistance. I haven't heard that one before, the bridge too far. I like that.
I'm writing it into a blog for the episode that's going out tomorrow, this idea, because the more that I saw what had happened, I realized a couple of things. The conceptual map that you were talking about is, pardon my French, it's a bitch, because of the way that it comes to us over so much time with so much engineering and even things like we know what effect this color and this tone have together. All of that packaged in and delivered as entertainment, the conceptual map becomes very strong for a lot of people. So as we went along, all these false events had been happening right along, but they were much smaller. But there were some big ones. We had JFK back in the day, but it did not get recognized or questioned in that way. When we get up to 9/11, we're coming up on the era shift, and that jolts people. But 2020 was, in my view, maybe almost rushed in ways they didn't want, because what I have noticed is that where I live, there is a ton of regret. I live in a neighborhood where there's a lot of old people who took the shot, and there is so much regret around it now. And I think the idea that I'm putting forward plays a role, and I call it the bridge too far.
Makes sense. I mean, even I realized that in trying to, how should I say that? What's a good verb? Trying to encourage colleagues, friends and colleagues, to open up and consider alternative ways of understanding the major narrative. I've gone a bridge too far a number of times over the past 6 years and have lost good friendships that I've had, you know, for decades. Yeah, it's been very difficult.
That's part of the insidious nature of what's just happened to us, because I think everybody has lost friendships, family relationships, and it almost feels like that was engineered into it. As an example of this, I have people who live around me that are the most educated people you're ever going to know, like a surgeon at that level. And they haven't talked to me. They were good friends with my mother, and we had been on good terms. They even shared a dog. The two families shared a dog. Well, my mother was at near the end of her life. She was out of it most of the time because of her mental state. And one of these people in the family I'm describing comes by and says, when are you taking your mom to get the shot? And I said, she's 90 years old. She's almost on death's door. She's not getting the shot. And neither am I. That was the last time they ever talked to me.
Wow.
And they're in the medical field. That's not true. There was one other conversation, and the conversation went like this. And this is a medically trained guy who's at the top of that field. And he started to say how my refusal to be vaccinated endangered everyone. So I decided to take a line of reasoning to see where it went. And I said, well, why did you get the vax? And he said, so that I didn't have to worry about getting sick. So I said, okay, so you're telling me when you get the vaccination, now you don't have to worry about the danger. And he said, yes. And I said, okay, using that logic, after you get the vaccination, the only one that's in danger here is me. I'm the only one who should face danger. And if I'm around anyone who's been vaccinated, then I am still the only one who's in danger. And the response I got was the most telling thing, because the logic is sound, obviously, on the face of it, but it was anger. And the anger was thrown at me in a way that tried to defend the obvious non-logic that he was trying to push forward in support of the medical procedure. And it's an astonishing thing to witness from the most educated people.
I mean, I think that's another really good example of the power of agitation propaganda. Scientists and What I've learned, maybe the most salient lesson for me over the past 6 years as an academic has been that academics aren't really academic. They're not,
no, they're in line, aren't they?
Yeah, it's
dependent on funding.
A lot of people say that the pharmaceutical industry has captured science and also academia. You can see lots and lots of big mainstream journals whose editors have come out over the past 20 years periodically decrying the wretched state of peer review and calling attention to the quote-unquote science. Lots and lots of papers, articles have come out saying that, in effect, science has been captured and academia has been captured. And it's not really the academy in the classical sense where we're all pursuing truth and beauty. It's really about pursuit of
defending ideas.
Yeah, grants.
Right.
Grant proposals, maintaining your funding stream for your pet project. And
well, let me jump in here, Daniel. We're getting close to the top of the hour, but I will offer this. In past episodes, we've talked about exactly what you're talking about, the state of scientism, as we refer to it. And I've come to the point where I offer up the idea that what science has done in the modern era has left us 2/3 blind. And the way that I demonstrate this is the older days when we had things like alchemy or natural sciences, any given thing in the world could be philosophically thought of as having body, spirit, and soul. But you could also go into the laboratory with, say, a flower and prove that it could be broken down into body, spirit, and soul. And in that, what we find in the modern scientism is they will only allow body into the conversation or the lab, leaving spirit and soul off the table, effectively leaving us 2/3 blind. But Jason, that does bring us close to the top of the first hour. Is there anything you'd like to get in?
Well, just to touch again on the language thing, they absolutely had propaganda ready to go on the news with language because they were saying the same things over and over again, like trust the science and flatten the curve, new normal. They had all these things ready to go. And of course, people fell for it and they repeated these slogans because that's really what they were.
Yeah, yeah, precisely.
So Daniel, we're gonna wrap up here and take a quick break and come back for hour two. Would you like to offer your websites or anything before we take a short break?
Sure. You can find a lot of the work we're doing at Propaganda in Focus. That's one word, Propaganda in Focus. You can easily find that in a Google search.
All right, we'll include these when it goes up into the comments at the top, but we are going to take a short break. That has been the first hour of episode 688. Hour one is free to everybody at crow777radio.com. Members know to log in for the full episode. Members get access to all the forums and comments sections. They get access to the two-hour film called Shoot the Moon, which has 10 awards in the world. Actually, a lot of people have been viewing that again and having some good things to say. You also get exclusive access to my current solar telescope work. Lastly, there are solar images that people had asked for that are available there, and the forums and comments sections are polite. There's one rule here, be polite, people follow it, and it's like night and day from social media. With that, we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back for hour two, and I'd like to wish you all a happy, healthy, and higher-minded new era. There it is, man. Cheers. We'll be right back.
is the enemy of knowing.